The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Caballero, no. Good, eh? Argentina's hopes hang by a thread as a Modric-inspired Croatia hammer them 3-0. Croatia superb, Argentina really bad. Elsewhere, in Group D, France failed to inspire but make it through to the last 16 with a 1-0 win over Peru, while Australia continue their promise to keep in the competition solely using Miller-Jedinak penalties, although they possibly deserved more than a point against Denmark. Also today, we'll talk to Dom Fifield about the possible leak of the England team. We'll take your questions, and that's today's Guardian World Cup Football Daily. On the panel today, Paul Doyle is here. Nice to see you.
You too, Max. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And Marcela Mora y Araujo. I'm worried to ask you how you are, but it's sort of the polite thing to do at the start of a podcast.
Well, I am well, thank you for asking. I have vented my frustrations by sneaking down for a cigarette and watching the third goal of Croatia in the bar. So there were some French people that were very surprised when I shouted a very rude word and stormed back up again, but I feel better for it, thanks.
Do you feel, I mean, because if this was England and we'd just been, I mean, Croatia are a good team, but if we'd just be played that badly and lost 3-0 and virtually guaranteed our exit from the World Cup, I would be devastated.
I think I can't be devastated, to be fair. It's incredibly frustrating at the time you watch, but I'm a grown up now. I've seen my team not do very well, and life goes on. I don't think it's catastrophic. I feel for the players. I think they're going to have a terrible backlash. The press back home are going to be unforgiving. I particularly feel for Willy Caballero, whom you called Caballero, but both are acceptable. I think he's going to take the, you know, brunt of it, and it's not all his fault, although obviously that first goal was a bad mistake. But it's clearly a massive shame in a way, because there was so much expectation riding on Messi. And really, I think it was a kind of fake expectation. It's like we're all mourning the loss of something that was never there. I don't think this was a great team at any point. It was kind of cobbled together at the last minute with little preparation. I was interested to hear from you guys that the Croatia manager hasn't been in charge. He's actually took over after Sampaoli, so he's obviously not worked that long with this team, but clearly something else is working in that system, in those players. Or they know each other, or they know what they're doing. They have a plan, which I don't think Argentina had, and I think that's a real shame, because the World Cup is a good opportunity to kind of, you know, you've got 4 years to work towards putting something together, and they've just not done it.
So for that reason, then Caballero won't take the brunt of the blame, will he? Because that was an individual error within a systemic meltdown, right?
Reasonable approach, yes. I think that gets lost a little bit. I mean, I was watching quite a lot of the Argentinian press over the last few days over YouTube after a colleague kind of said, you've got to watch these programs. And there's literally, just journalists demented with kind of screaming, swearing, literally kind of shouting, Enzo Perez is a... Can we swear?
I mean, we try not to, but, you know, if you're feeling emotional...
If you're feeling emotional,
you can.
Not my own emotion, it's not. But so, very, very harsh criticisms, really without filters, and kind of, interestingly, on all the time. So people were saying to me, talk to us about England. Is the whole of England really delighted after their win? How are people viewing it? And I think in central London, you can literally go out in the street when England are playing a World Cup game and not know that's happening. There's enough going on. There's enough other people, otherness. It doesn't take over. And Argentina, it seems to have completely taken over without really any kind of qualification for it. Because if you're getting to the semi-final or the final, I can understand that everybody kind of gets, you know, completely hyped up and wants to discuss the World Cup all the time, every minute of the day. So there is a lot of airtime to fill. And I think, as you say, Caballero's or Caballero's mistake is just one mistake in a kind of wholeness of a lack of system. But he's still... Well, I've already, in the kind of few minutes since the game finished, received a ton of messages going, if he hadn't made that mistake, then the whole kind of psyche of the team would have been different. So he's like, open the door.
But if I was an Argentina fan, I would be asking, should Rebic be on the pitch? It was a fantastic finish from a terrible mistake from Caballero. But in the first half, Paul, Rebic absolutely goes studs up, you know, treads on the guy's ankle. VAR look at it, but don't change the ref's decision.
Yeah, and I can't explain that. VAR has got some decisions right and some decisions wrong. So really, I don't know how much of an improvement it is. It's just sort of shifted the locus of contention from the man in the middle to a faceless bureaucrat in the stands. And in that sense, it's the perfect apparatus for our times.
Yeah, as Barry pointed out, soon there'll be VAR on the VAR, so it'll just keep going on on.
Meta-VAR.
Exactly. Luka Modric, we were waxing lyrical about Modric before he scored that excellent goal as well, Paul. It was a lovely finish, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely beautiful. From probably the best player on the pitch, wasn't he? He just glides through, always doing his own thing in his own time.
Yeah, I mean, we were waxing lyrical about him. I think it was interesting because... purely psychologically, as Argentina diminished and kind of crumbled and became more chaotic, Croatia seemed to become stronger and more determined and organised. But Luka Modric was fantastic. And if my heart wasn't so tied into the fate of those young Argentinian boys, I would have really been rooting for him. I think you're absolutely right about the fouls committed earlier that are questionable, but he was just spectacular and played excellent football throughout, and then had that beautiful goal, which is when I swore in the bar and the French people started staring at me.
And that what made it was a lot of chaos in the match, right from the start, chaos and a real panicky feel to it, which made for a sort of gripping spectacle, but also made Modric's poise all the more impressive.
Miguel Delaney tweeted at half-time that Sampaoli's system has made Argentina hugely vulnerable down the flanks, where it looked like any bad bounce would do them. It took Messi out of the game as a centre-forward. Their least technically able players had the ball the most. And there is... you want, I suppose, people who don't watch Argentina a lot and people who don't watch La Liga that much but see Messi being amazing are desperate to see him doing that on the world stage. And it's harder when you don't have the same players around you, isn't it?
And when your manager isn't up to much. Because he was also, if we're attributing a lot of the blame for this to the manager's lack of cohesion, we also remember, was it 2006 under Peckerman, when his disastrous substitutions undermined Argentina. So he hasn't been lucky in the managers he's had.
Well, it's interesting about 2006 because... Peckerman left Messi on the bench against Germany just the last game, and Messi, I think, had only played two games before that, and he was very young. And what we know about Messi now and his kind of, you know, quite strange personality, very difficult to understand the character, his frustration, and possibly the type of game that Peckerman was gearing up for against a, you know, super powerful German side, it could have happened that Messi went on and they also lost disastrously, and then Messi had a complete meltdown that was long-lasting. So in a way, knowing Peckerman quite well, I would say he was probably thinking, the kid's too young, too green, and I'm not sure it's good for him. But he was unanimously kind of vilified for that decision. Then the other, that what he did was the opposite of what Sampaoli did today, because he brought in Cruz, didn't he, and hoping that a tall, strong defender might be able to just head the ball far away. And today instead of getting some tall defenders, which we don't have, but any kind of defending at all, Higuain came on and Aguero came off. So it's a kind of opposite bad substitution. But I guess, well, going back to the system, I mean, the rumours are that the Sampaoli loves three at the back, and he loves kind of using the flanks and opening up, and he likes players that move between lines, and he has been saying throughout that he's put aside his own personal preferences because four at the back seemed what the players were comfortable with, and with the lack of preparation and the lack of, you know, some of these players never ever even met at all to say hello before a week before the World Cup. So, and then this week, apparently, I mean, I don't know this to be the case, but this is what's being reported. Sampaoli said, okay, Messi, this is what we're going to do. We're going to try my way, three at the back, and this is what we're going to try. And so on the one hand, he was, you know, cheered for finally saying, I'm the manager and we'll do it my way. And I think the backlash against him personally is going to be massive as well, because it was clearly a shambles. And I think it shows that more than a formation or a name or one system or other or one player or another, Argentina's really, really showing what lack of work and lack of preparation ends up in, especially when the rivals, regardless of their football tradition or how big the country is, where they play, the countries that have done the work, that have actually prepared match by match, looked at their rivals, thought about what the guy they're going to mark or be standing next to is likely to do, those are the nations that are coming through, with no regard at all for a preference of style or beautiful football or whatever. And France are being criticised left, right and centre, but they are literally with their hands in their pockets going, we just want to walk through this one and then see.
It's interesting, isn't it? And it's a top-heavy squad, Argentina. It's got loads of great attacking players. They don't have great defensive players. I mean, you look at Croatia, it looks like a much more balanced team. Yes, they've got Rakitic and Modric who are played brilliantly, and Mandzukic, who had missed a great chance, but had a good game. But Lovren played well, Vida played well at the back as well. Do you want us to move on from this game, Marcelo?
Well, should we lob a little bit of mud at Messi? To what extent has he flopped in general for Argentina? Maradona, even within all these problems around him, he would have had more of an impact, wouldn't he? Even if it was just booting someone.
I've seen Maradona have zero impact on games from a very young age, you know, myself and him. I think it's a very tough one for Messi, because he clearly had a couple of moments and you could see him trying, and obviously the Messi that we, you know, that Max was referring to earlier just didn't come through. He wasn't given that space to move in. He didn't find that kind of dialogue with his teammates. But I don't think he was disastrous. I mean, he was largely absent from the screen.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, Maradona wouldn't have been.
Yeah.
it feeds into the idea that if his surroundings aren't perfect, as they are at Barcelona, he can't influence events as much as Maradona was able to.
No, I think he couldn't influence events today at all. But what I meant by, I mean, I know you're laughing about him being absent from the screen, but what I mean is the least able players were the ones who had the ball the most. And I don't think there was much Messi alone could do to address that imbalance. But generally, he generates moves, he creates assists, he opens spaces. But today and against Iceland, that didn't come through at all. And I'm not sure. I mean, my sister just was bellowing down the phone at me going, why doesn't he get a therapist? They all need therapists. I don't know if therapy would help
them.
That's
big in everyone in Argentina has a therapist. Exactly. It's huge in Argentina.
It's huge. Big. New York tops and then Buenos Aires, I believe. But anyway, but I do think it's a shame that he couldn't kind of be, you know, we've seen the Ronaldo just kind of emerge as Ronaldo, and everyone, you know, kind of wanting to be Messi, to be more Messi than he has been. I think that's a really unfair call, to be honest. I think the guy did what he could, clearly under certain duress.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he's a test tube footballer. You can only function in laboratory conditions. Whereas Ronaldo, despite the sheen to his appearance, is much more of a street footballer, just like Maradona was.
Yes, so I think so you're on really a, right, on a, actually.
On a, you know, on the cold Tuesday night in Stoke, you'd take Ronaldo every time, would you?
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting point. And that's where we'll end part one. The pain over for you, Marcelo. We'll look at Group D in part two. Welcome to part two. Denmark 1, Australia 1. Let's chat to Kieran Pender, who was there for the game, presumably from a reporting from a slightly Australian point of view. Kieran, is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. It's always tough when you're covering your home team. And I must admit, I felt a little bit deflated after the 1-1 draw when really Australia were the better team. Denmark started very strongly. They scored a really nice goal, actually, probably up there with goal of the tournament, a good combination from Christian Eriksen and Nikolaj Jorgensen in the 7th minute. Socceroos got back into the game, and then once they equalised from a penalty, it was all the Socceroos and were really disappointed themselves and disappointed the 15 or so thousand Australian fans who made the trip to Samara. They weren't able to finish it off.
Yeah, I'm pretty objective. I mean, the future Mrs. Rushton is Australian, as everybody knows. So I was rooting for you. I mean, the penalty was interesting, wasn't it? It was an interesting use of VAR because, I mean, maybe I just don't know the laws of football, but I thought that was a very harsh handball decision against Poulsen.
Yeah, I agree. Me and a few of my press box colleagues were also scratching our head a little bit. Poulsen rose to challenge Matthew Leckie, I think it was, the Australian winger who was rising to meet a corner, and he headed it down straight into the hand of Poulsen. The referee waved play on and then a moment later stopped and went over to the VAR and decided to give the penalty despite the fact that, to my mind, his hand was in a natural position and the ball was just heading downwards. Socceroos fans certainly are complaining. You and the rest of the world will recall that there was a lot of anger in the Australian camp after the VAR determined penalty that France were awarded against Australia in the opening match. So in some ways, this is perhaps redemption.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, you sort of think as soon as the ref is sent to that little, to the screen, that he almost feels obliged to do whatever the refs in the back room have told him.
Exactly.
I thought Matthew Leckie looked really good, actually. Of all the players that I didn't know a lot about before this tournament started, he really impressed me.
Yeah, Leckie was strong on the wing, and that was a marked contrast to Robbie Cruz, who wasn't quite as good on the other flank. I thought Tom Rogic was probably the pick of the Socceroos, the Celtic star. He's quite the mercurial midfielder. Sometimes he shines, sometimes he scores incredible goals and sets up very impressive chances. Other times he's largely anonymous, as he was against France. He really drove Australia forward. Unfortunately, he was taken off late in the second half and wasn't able to spark a winner, which leaves Australia in a difficult position going into the final match day.
What are people saying at home? I've seen a lot of people back in Australia desperate for Tim Cahill to get on the pitch. I sort of feel he might not be able to run as much as you'd need someone to be able to run, but he does score goals.
Yeah, I think there would have been a chance that Cahill would have come on at the very end of this game, but Andrew Naboo, our striker, went down with a shoulder injury, and that's ruled him out of the rest of the tournament. And that meant the manager, Bert van Marwijk, had to make a sudden change and bring on a like-for-like striker. So I think that probably ruled out Cahill today. There's a chance. I think, yeah, he's such a talisman for the Australian team. He does noticeably boost them when he's on the pitch. I wouldn't be surprised. So Australia, to go through from here, essentially need to defeat Peru and to see France beat Denmark and then to have a better goal difference than Denmark. So it could be that a couple of goals are required against Peru in Sochi on Tuesday. And I wouldn't be surprised if Tim Cahill reprises his old role as Socceroos' saviour and comes on at death.
Now, we have a big following in Australia. We also have a reasonably big following in Denmark as well. We've performed live in Copenhagen. So we should look at it from a Danish angle. Apart from the Eriksen strike, they didn't really get going. And Eriksen himself didn't have his best game, did he?
No, Denmark again underwhelmed, as they did against Peru in the opening match. I spoke to a few Danish journalists after the game, and they were roundly of the view that Denmark were lucky and were also lucky against Peru. But that luck has favoured them, and they have 4 points, whereas Australia have one. I thought Eriksen, really impressive opening goal. Otherwise, was reasonably quiet. Paulsen, that's two matches in two that he's conceded a penalty. So I think he might be having a word with his manager.
The Australians, they drank Kazan dry, didn't they, of beer? How are they getting on in Samara?
They're having a great time. Samara is home to the Zaguli Brewery, which apparently produced the most sought-after beer in the Soviet Union. Apparently, in the Soviet times, Zaguli beer was actually essentially a synonym for beer. That's how ubiquitous it was. And so this morning, I actually tagged along on a brewery tour with some Australian fans. They were drinking at 9 a.m. I'm sure it's been a long day and heading into a long night for them. And then they'll have a chance to do it all again in Sochi. I read a good piece that the famous anti-doping testing lab in Sochi has been turned into a pub. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Australians try and drink that one dry as well.
Kieran, thanks for your time. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
Kieran Pender there, reporting for The Guardian. Interesting, Marcel, converting a drug testing lab into a bar. I mean, there's all sorts of dangers if they haven't properly cleaned it.
Well, I think it shows amazing kind of imagination to just turn everything that's part of the local folklore into something commercial. So I just saw a story about this in the New York Times or somewhere that was just saying it's now a gastropub and they serve performance-enhancing motivated cocktails. So it's a themed bar and gastropub. And I think that's just genius, really, because why not? I mean, why not make a, you know, tourism industry out of whatever story is attached to a place? I mean, everywhere else people are talking about the horrors of wars and all the other historical events that have happened in every city in Russia, and this one's got this kind of rather cheerful side, which is like, hey.
France, Peru. You did the minute-by-minute of this game, Paul, and you were saying if you do the minute-by-minute, it changes your view of a game because you like to be positive so that people reading it are happy with their lives.
That was my mood today.
Okay.
And in other times, matches are such that you just can't be positive. But the Peruvian fans made it positive. I've cranked up the volume on my headphones, and they were in party mode from the start, which was quite intoxicating. And the first half was good. Both teams went at it. And Peru, very much like Morocco, they're quite thrilling going forward right up until they get to the box, where it all just unravels and they don't know what to do, which is a real pity. And France were quite good in the first half. They hinted at what they could become at some point in Didier Deschamps' reign. He's only been there for 6 years. And it's funny how they are the antithesis of what he was as a player. He was a very dependable and dynamic and consistent player. And this France team are utterly inconsistent. They don't have any kind of identity or shape. He doesn't know what personnel he'll deploy. But although today, Olivier Giroud, who was brought back into the side, I think made sure that he will be a fixture for the foreseeable future, because he was really good as a forward fulcrum and gave them a nice platform up front for various very skillful players to flit around, and he was instrumental in the goal, and he did a lot of good things. Pogba, I should mention, was also instrumental in the goal, as he was instrumental in their two goals against Australia. And yet still, he will be criticised because he doesn't exert an influence on a regular basis. But today he played with simplicity, which he often lacks. He likes to, not quite to the extent of Neymar, but he does like to dwell on the ball and just show how good he is. But he was very efficient today for a lot of it. But again, that was only in patches. And France are they're a patchy team, you know. If Didier Deschamps was a water carrier, these are Jack, you know, they'd fall down the hill with their pail of water and spill it.
Would either of you like to feel old?
I do.
Kylian and Mbappe, I believe this is correct, the first player to score at a World Cup who was born after France 98.
Okay.
It's devastating, mm-hmm. isn't it? He doesn't remember Euro 96. That was the best one. I thought Peru were miles better in the second half. They had a good chance before Mbappe scored in the first half. But you're absolutely right. Correa down the right was good. Jacob Steinberg wrote this tweet from the heartless department. He said, plucky little Peru, haven't scored in two games, barely created a chance today, spirited and ambitious, and their fans are good, but they won't really be a loss to the tournament. Marcella, do you share that view of Peru?
I don't think Peru were ever really contenders to go through, and they've just been delightful in that way that we all like to see fans that are happy and teams that are trying and, you know, trying, not giving up and enjoying the kind of chance to be part of the party or whatever. But who do you really miss?
Italy aren't there and Holland aren't even there, and I'm not missing them, I must admit.
Exactly.
Peru are out then, France are through. Can you see France growing? I mean, you've said this, Deschamps's been there for 6 years. They still don't look great, but they've got such wonderful players. Philippe Auclair has been saying this relentlessly, that Deschamps is not the right guy. But could you, now they're through and they've got a fantastic opportunity, haven't they?
They do, and because they have such great players and they do hit patches of form, then they are capable of blowing away any team with, you know, a spell of 20 minutes of brilliance. And maybe he will stumble upon a formula the way he kind of did in Euro 2016, although they still couldn't win that. They could still be dangerous opponents to anyone. But by the same token, they could go out in the next round.
They'll go far, I think they... They're confident in their shambolicness and they're not scared. So.
I think they're flaky, though. I don't think they're confident. They even today, Umtiti, and he wasn't the only one, but they do make mistakes when they're put under pressure. Even Hugo Lloris, who's celebrated his 100th cap today, he's been jittery in recent months, and he's supposed to be the captain and the wise head.
And Umtiti did go a little bit Pepe with a ridiculous collapse, didn't he? And we should mention, we forgot in the Argentina chat, Otamendi, that, I mean, of all the terrible fouls in that game, that was just, I mean, that was peak Pepe. It was worse than Pepe, actually. I mean, just sort of.
It was kind of irresistible, though. I mean,
if you didn't see it, the free kick was already given and the ball was just lying by a Croatia player. So he managed to boot the ball and the player. It was, yes, peak Pepe. That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll chat to Dominic Fifield, who's following England, and have a quick look ahead to tomorrow's games too. Welcome to part three of the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Before we look ahead to tomorrow's games, let's catch up with Dom Fifield following England. Dom, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Max. How are you doing?
Having a nice time. The big story coming out of England today is that Steve Holland may have been carrying the team sheet, and some crafty photographer got a photo of it, and now the English media press pack have ruined our chances of winning the World Cup.
because we've really stopped them beating Panama on Sunday. Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's lifted straight up the script from the thick of it, really, isn't it? It's given that Steve Holland is the member of the England coaching staff who's most paranoid, apparently, about the leaking of the team, it does seem quite ironic that he's the one that is photographed with that piece of paper in his hand ahead of the session. Maybe Gareth Southgate would have been carrying it had he been able to use his right arm after his unfortunate jogging accident the previous night. But look, it's been telegraphed to a certain extent that we always knew there was a choice to make between Marcus Rashford and Raheem Sterling. And if anything, I mean, I've written a piece for the Guardian this evening, so it does show, if indeed Rashford is starting on Sunday, it shows that Southgate is operating a meritocracy. I mean, he probably does warrant a start. Raheem Sterling hasn't scored since October 2015. He's 21 games ago. He's only two goals at international level against Lithuania and Estonia. So maybe it is time to see whether Rashford playing gives a bit of bite to that team, a bit more ruthlessness to a side that creates a lot of chances but doesn't always put them away.
And it shows a ruthlessness to Southgate. People mentioned that when he dropped Rooney, he does it in a, it's a subtle ruthlessness, isn't it, rather than a sort of loud and brash one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if this is the case, and we have to say that it was just, it appears from that sheet that it does, there will be changes. But I have no doubt that Raheem Sterling, even if he doesn't start that game on Sunday, he will come on. And it might be good for him to run at a tiring Panamanian defence later on. It might be providing with that opportunity, that bit of luck that he's been lacking at international level in recent years. We all know he's got the quality. We've seen it at Manchester City. It's just that England don't create quite as many chances as Manchester City do on a match basis. And he's snatching at those opportunities he does get with England because he's a bit anxious in that respect. But look, he's a player with huge, huge quality and still potential. He's only 23, so we're not going to write him off. I suspect he will still have a big say in England's progress in this tournament. But that said, Marcus Rashford was excellent against Costa Rica, Central American opposition, just prior to this tournament. So maybe there is a logic in giving him an opportunity against Panama.
I mean, it's slightly strange that these guys need to carry around team sheets with the team on it. You'd sort of think they might know what it is without having to write it down.
Yeah, I can only imagine that a lot of it was based around drills that they were going to perform out on training once the media have been asked to leave, which we only get 15 minutes at the start of the session, and then we get asked to leave. There were photographs, official FA photographs from that session where the bibs on the players have changed colour over the course of the session. So he's not trained with one team throughout that, whatever it was, an hour and a half out on the pitch in Rapinha. But I just think it sort of ticks the boxes. Ruben Loftus-Cheek coming in for the injured Dele Alli makes all the sense, given the cameo that he had on Monday and indeed the way he's played since returning from injury late March, early April at Crystal Palace. He deserves his place in the team as well. And there has been a pattern and a logic about everything Southgate has done over his tenure to date. So on that basis, Rashford and Ruben Loftus-Cheek playing on Sunday, it just makes sense. It feels right.
Dom, thank you for your time as always.
Pleasure. See you soon.
Yeah, chat soon. Dom Fifield there, following the England side. England, of course, play Panama on Sunday. Tomorrow starts with Group E, Brazil versus Costa Rica. And, Paul, we are expecting Brazil to do more than they did against Switzerland. They looked good, didn't they, for the first sort of 10, 20 minutes? And then Switzerland just sort of ground them down a bit.
I read a report in one of the Sao Paulo newspapers.
This is the sort of research that, you know, this takes you to the next level.
Well, it stood out, really, because they described that match against New Switzerland as Brazil's worst World Cup performance for 40 years. It's like they've just pretended that 7-1 against Germany never happened. And I am intrigued, by the way, to see what kit Brazil will wear tomorrow. I suspect it'll be their traditional one. But they did. The last time Brazil played Costa Rica in the World Cup was in 1990. And Costa Rica wore their second kit, which they just changed just before the tournament, to be exactly the same as Juventus's kit, because the match was in Turin and they thought they'd get all the home fans on their side.
Genius.
And they performed well. They lost narrowly. But then in that match, Germany, you might remember, when the 7-1 match, Germany wore black and red away their second strip, which was they had chosen to be the same colours as Flamengo because they were celebrating their centenary and they wanted to pay tribute to Flamengo. And then they went and bashed Brazil 7-1. Now, Brazil's have chosen an away kit for this tournament that happens to be exactly the same colours as Zenit St. Petersburg's jersey, and the match is in St. Petersburg. So I'm wondering if they're going to wear that.
I went to see Flamengo play once, and Adriano was playing, and he was enormous by this time. And the best bit of the whole thing was at half time, the TV reporters just interviewed him for 15 minutes. And he must have thought the manager must have been just in the dressing room going,
Is he coming back?
They did literally interview him for the whole thing.
Do you remember when France played Hungary in the 1978 World Cup in Argentina?
Yes.
And France were wearing blue, Hungary were wearing red, and someone pointed out that on black and white TV, which was still very prevalent back then, people might not be able to distinguish them. So France had to change colours, and they went into
white.
The white and green stripes. They were the side. They borrowed the jerseys off the local club side, Atletico Kimberley. Which sounds like someone's fantasy league team, and turned them inside out. So they were white, but you could just see the green stripes through.
Costa Rica lost to Serbia. Similar in a way, I think, to, you know, maybe I'm giving them too much credit. Like Peru and Morocco in, they gave it a go. They look like they've got something about them. They're not the minnows that we sort of have in our mind that they are, because obviously they won the group with England and Uruguay and Italy 4 years ago, even if they're a bit older generally as a side. But you can't see them getting anything out of this game.
No, they do get stuck in, don't they? So I dare say Neymar will be spending a lot of time on the ground tomorrow.
Yes, they probably watched how Barami stayed very close to Neymar. That'll be interesting to see. Certainly in Brazilian news, Fred has signed from Shakhtar Donetsk to Manchester United on a five-year contract. Nigeria, Iceland tomorrow. Nigeria were very poor, I thought, against Croatia, wasn't it? And Iceland were very good against Argentina. But now we've seen Croatia are really good and Argentina are rubbish. Maybe, I don't know what that tells us.
Well, no, Nigeria were really poor. Their attitude, they were just so listless throughout. It was a bizarre performance, listless and quite negative, and a complete non-performance. And they can't play like that against Iceland. Iceland are kind of like taking your car for an MOT. They're just a basic roadworthiness test. They just do the basics really well. If you don't do the basics, you'll fail. And Nigeria have failed to do the basics recently, including from set pieces, which of course Iceland are very strong from. So if they don't up their game and do what they're very capable of doing, then they will flunk to an embarrassing defeat, which I hope doesn't happen. I hope that they show their qualities and play more on the front foot and with a bit more invention and use the skills that they have. I'd like to see them also, frankly, just jettison Odinigalo up front and play Simi Nwankwo, the big 6'5" striker with a silky touch for a big man, and give him a go, and maybe drop Mikel a bit deeper and play a table further forward and attack.
Serbia play Switzerland as well. This is the 7 o'clock kickoff. Interesting sort of side note in this game is that the number of, there are three players. There's Jordan Shaqiri, Granit Xhaka and Valen Bajrami, who are originally from Kosovo, and Kosovo is obviously not recognised by Serbia. Shaqiri will be wearing footwear that displays the stitched flag of Kosovo. There's been a bit of sort of to and forth on Instagram and Twitter between some of, you know, Mitrovic saying, well, why don't you play for Kosovo then? So that sort of needle will be there.
I'm surprised FIFA allow that. They normally clamp down on any sort of display of anything other than
political affiliations, which presumably this isn't.
Perhaps because it's on his right foot. They haven't seen it because Jordan Shaqiri hasn't used his right foot, you know, sort of for the last 20 years. In other news, Burger King have apologised after offering women 3 million rubles, that's £36,000.
3 million, it's gone up since I first saw this.
And free Whopper burger, free Whoppers for life if they got pregnant with a World Cup player's baby. In advertising and the media, apparently Russian women are being portrayed as sexual predators hunting their prey, apparently. There have been several articles on how women bait foreign fans and chat them up. But yes, Burger King have apologised. Do we know if they've removed the offer now?
I think they have.
They have removed the offer. So the chance, you know.
I think, I mean.
You know, if any Russian wanted to sort of grab a footballer, it's too late now.
Well, it's grotesquely offensive, isn't it?
Isn't it? I mean, it's terrible.
It's really, really out of order. It's not a laughing matter.
It isn't, but because it's so ridiculous.
She says while laughing.
Well, I could test, because it's so ludicrous, I'd say it is a laughing matter while also being grossly offensive. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
In football news, Julian Nagelsmann has left Hoffenheim. And he's signed a four-year deal with RB Leipzig that comes into effect in 2019. And that's pretty much everything. Great commiserations to you tonight, Marcella.
Thank you. Thank you kindly.
Stunning performance. It was hard. Given the emotional heartache you've been through. Paul, thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, that's okay.
Thank you, Marcella. I don't suppose it's any consolation, but watching Argentina's ignominy with you it made it a more enriching experience than if I'd been sitting by myself watching.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.